Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Pooler, and my guest today is Brendan Dunn, and he is here to talk about the effort to organize adjunct professors. So, Brendan, can you give us a little overview of the problem, how bad it is, you know, nationwide?
Yeah, thanks for having me again on the show, Cynthia. So I think the problems are, I mean, it's not just at one college, it's systemic, it's endemic, it's across the whole country. It's what I would call, you know, a major crisis of higher ed. Would even maybe go as far as to say it's a catastrophe in many respects. But we've seen a major shift over the last 40 years in particular. You know, under the current kind of phase, most recent iteration of capitalism that we're all living under, you know, more extreme consolidation of wealth and power into the hands of fewer and fewer people, you know, through what many call neoliberalism. It's just kind of unchecked market system and a major push to privatization, gutting of any of the positive things that may have been associated with the state, with government, such as, you know, resources for a social safety net, resources and support for public education, both in the primary and the secondary level. And, you know, we're seeing that withering away. And with that, we have seen the push towards, from a major emphasis and focus on education, on learning in the university system, to instead prop up other things and focus on other things, and also different structures of how universities are and colleges are run. So within all of that, you know, we've seen a major rise in the cost of tuition for not just private schools, but also for state schools and even at the community college level. And we've also seen an over-reliance on labor that is much more easily exploited and taken advantage of by employers, by presidents and administrations of colleges and universities, that being adjunct and contingent faculty, but also grad student workers, increasingly different universities kind of taking the place of, you know, 40 plus years ago, what normally the work that would normally be done by tenured and tenured track faculty. And so these are tenured and tenured track faculty are professors that have, you know, longer term job security, they have higher pay, they have better benefits. Adjunct faculty, of course, you know, for most of us, we are kind of living and working semester to semester, not knowing next semester if we're going to get any classes. If so, what days, what times are they going to be? I know I talked about this on a previous show, but just to give a brief example, my work as an adjunct professor, I would, you know, work 60 hours a week normally. I'd work 6 to 7 days a week. I would teach normally three credit classes, sometimes more classes in addition to that. So and for all these classes, I would have 40 students in a class. They're all writing in research intensive classes. And, you know, I had no health insurance. I had no stability, no job security. I had no retirement plan. And I, you know, my salary at the end of the year was about $12,000 for that. And that was just me. I could talk about a friend and coworker of mine who's an adjunct professor at three different college campuses currently, at two different colleges, and also works as a tutor, works as, and, you know, volunteers essentially as a faculty advisor for a student group, and also works in the bookstore on campus. And in addition to all that work as a professor, you know, is doing research, writing books, getting paid for that, and also working in the garden center at the Lowe's in his town. All he does is work. And, you know, it just comes to a point where it's a breaking point. And it not just impacts us, you know, these deplorable working conditions doesn't just impact us as faculty. It impacts our students and it impacts the whole culture of what, you know, the supposed vision and purpose of colleges and universities are. And it's not, you know, the faculty certainly don't come first and the students don't come first. It's a profit-driven system, and there are many institutions and many people through, you know, the exploitation of the workforce at these colleges, but also through the exploitation of the students by pushing them into just obscene amounts of debt that they will never realistically be able to pay off. And so they're punished for that by higher and higher interest rates. It's just a never-ending vicious cycle. And I think that's what this major push towards unionization is trying to push back against and make a dent in. We need to ebb the flow of this rising tide of, you know, accumulation of wealth and power into the hands of fewer people, and a deeply flawed system which is not really focusing on education and not supporting the faculty or the students.
How did this come about? I mean, back in the day when I went to college, I don't ever remember hearing the word adjunct professor. You know, they were full tenures. How did this come about that only a handful of, maybe a little more than a handful, but not a lot of professors in each college have tenure? What happened?
That's a great question. I think there's a number of different variables and things that factor into this equation. And, you know, I think what we're seeing in higher ed and higher education is not necessarily unique, because we're seeing that just across the board. You name the industry, we're seeing that there. I mean, we could talk about, you know, public transportation, but also we could look at and how that's been chipped away, you know, talking about this current stage of capitalism that we're living under, where different things in terms of the social safety net, or, you know, in terms of, you know, public transportation, seeing that as a human right and a public resource and a public good, you know, that has, you know, there's just not as many buses, not as many trains as there used to be. And of course, that has led to, you know, just people not, you know, not being able to get certain places or having to rely more on taxis. And of course, now we are seeing, you know, with the ascent of Uber and Lyft and all these different kinds of, you know, forms of transportation. I mean, that is, you know, these are not stable jobs. You can't make a living or a career off of that. It's hard enough to do that as a taxi driver, but with the public transportation, generally speaking, they were unionized across the board all over the country, and people had, you know, made pretty decent money and could get a pension and all the benefits that are connected to, you know, being a union member. And if there's a major assault on public transportation, it doesn't just affect the passengers, it affects the workers and who are in unions. It affects unionization in that industry. And so now we have a large, you know, an extremely ununionized kind of industry now, which is now, it's more increasingly being dominated by Lyft and Uber, even though a number of those workers went on strike. They're organizing unions in other countries. But, you know, a lot of these Uber and Lyft drivers, they, you know, it's what some people like to call the gig economy. I don't normally call it that, but, you know, they're scrabbling together multiple jobs, multiple part-time jobs, and working, you know, more than overtime every single week, but not being able to pay off their any kind of debt that they're in, student debt or other forms of debt, not being able to start families, not being able to buy homes if that's what they want to do, and not being able to save for retirement or anything like that. We are seeing that, you know, in higher ed too. It's like an adjunct professor. I was talking to some adjunct professors at a community college yesterday, and we agreed that, you know, we are not unlike Uber drivers. We're working multiple jobs. And that's what we're, you know, and we're not even making a minimum wage, you know, with the work that we're doing. So I think it's a trend that we've seen everywhere. And again, you know, speaking on this theme and emphasizing that this is, you know, this is this is a path we've been going down for quite a long time. It's just the logic, if we want to call it that, it's a logic of the economic system that we live under. And, you know, Marx and others wrote about this in the 1800s, in the later 1800s, that as capitalism progresses over time, one major element of that evolution and progression is the consolidation of wealth and power, is the accumulation of profit into the hands of fewer people, and is the destruction of certain things like what we're seeing, what maybe we thought was the ideal or the norm for higher education, seeing things like that is, you know, public transportation, things like this as the norm, things like this is accessible to more people than it's accessible to now. So I think, you know, it's not unique. It's something that we've seen across the board in other industries. But of course, I guess the final note I would say on that, you know, just on like a bigger, deeper political economics kind of position is that, you know, the current phase of capitalism we are living under is what some economists have called the financialization of capital. And that is, you know, especially in the U.S., we can see it, but this is a global phenomenon. We are living in an economic system where, you know, capitalism, the most profit that's made, it's not from making goods, like manufacturing things. It's not even being made from providing services like healthcare or education or other things like that. It's being made from, you know, the financialization of capital. And that's through what people call FIRE. That's finance investments in real estate. So, you know, the most accumulation of profit is made from all kinds of things, just buying and selling commodities, buying and selling different currencies for different nations, you know, investing in real estate, investing in finance. And that's why we saw this major bubble burst in 2007, 2008, that was the housing market. You know, that's a prime example of like the financialization of capital and how it blows back against us, you know, common people and common workers. And we're seeing that again now within this bigger crisis of higher ed, and that's through the financialization of capital and the financialization of higher ed. And we're going to see that with a student loan crisis. That's the next bubble that's going to burst and maybe tank the economy. And it's not a question of if it'll burst. It's a simple question of when that will burst. But the solution, you know, is rather simple, believe it or not. It's going back to basics. It's forming unions. It's going on strike. It's disrupting business as usual by, you know, broader organization. And not just from the workers, not just from the professors, but from students. And also students, you know, refusing to pay off their debt on a mass scale. I mean, that's going to help too.
When I look at education, for instance, high school teachers, they're pretty well set. They get a good, they make a good living. They have a pension at the end of their career. They have health insurance, and they live okay. Do you think at some point, the problems that are going on the college level is going to also trickle down to the secondary school level?
I think we're already there, actually. I'd say absolutely, because it is all connected within a broader, you know, economic and political system. And while it is true that generally speaking, teachers in the public school system at least tend to have it better than, you know, adjunct faculty, for example, and they get paid salaries, you know, they tend to be in some places more so than others. So it's, you know, not all public school teachers in Florida, for example, are in unions. They are in New York State. They are in other states. With that union membership that, you know, comes with pensions, that comes with a good salary, that comes with, you know, retirement and all these other benefits, comes with, you know, there's an organization and power to that. But, you know, we have seen a major assault on K-12 education, specifically public schools, from those in power, from, you know, it's not the Republicans, it's the Democrats too. I mean, a big foe of the teachers union and of public education in the state of New York is Governor Andrew Cuomo, who is a Democrat. So this is a bipartisan assault that's backed by rich and powerful forces to attack teachers unions, to attack public education. So there has been a decrease in the standard of living for public school teachers. You know, they have been public enemy number one for a number of years, and we're seeing the results of that, how it impacts, you know, our communities, how it impacts, you know, students that go to these schools. The classroom sizes are increasing. There's always, you know, a struggle to get just very basic amenities and resources for students, like books and paper and things that, you know, these poor school districts, like, can't really provide and don't really have, you know, for all the students. So I think, yeah, it's definitely trickled down. It's trickled up. I mean, it affects both, you know, primary, secondary, you know, higher education. And I think another, like, great but, you know, really tragic example of what this assault on teachers and on public schools in particular look like, you know, in this current age of the financialization of capital that we're living in. You know, we could talk about New York State and, you know, the push for, like, a common core, and this kind of regimentation and consolidation of how things are run, and how, you know, there's this over-reliance on teaching to the test and from a really early age, and teaching to the test and really subjects and classes that you don't and shouldn't do that. Like in music and art, you should just not have that, shouldn't have to exist in those classes. I mean, I'm not a fan of any test in general. I think there's better ways to learn and to teach. But, you know, that's another question for another day. I think a tragic example is New Orleans. I mean, after Hurricane Katrina just devastated that city, and the American government just sat there letting, you know, predominantly black working class people just die from this hurricane, and their inability, their refusal to, you know, the government's refusal to really take action and help out and save these folks. And the destruction, there are two waves of destruction in Hurricane Katrina, which was back in, I'm trying to remember, 2005, I believe, in fall of 2005. The second wave of that crisis was what happened to the city afterwards. And that's when, you know, Naomi Klein wrote an excellent book called The Shock Doctrine, what she calls disaster, you know, capitalism. There are economic and political and sometimes, and, you know, related to the weather. It wasn't just simply the weather. It was also economic and political in New Orleans with Hurricane Katrina. Periods of time and moments in history and in the world today where there's some kind of crisis. And so those that are in power, you know, they resuscitate that. They provide some, like, shock therapy, but not to save it for, you know, address the crisis for the betterment of all. It's to address the crisis for the benefit of the rich and powerful. And so in New Orleans, what that looked like was a massive privatization of the public school system. So New Orleans today is a very different New Orleans that existed 15, 20 years ago. New Orleans today is overwhelmingly charter schools. And so what do you get with charter schools? You get a very different kinds of education, different structure. Generally speaking, there are very few unions in charter schools. It is a responsibility for taxpayers and for municipal governments, for example, to pay for charter schools in part. But on the flip side, it's not the responsibility of charter schools to accept all students. So if they, you know, they, you know, for example, in order to kind of create this false image that, hey, you know, we have the best and brightest students, what we're doing with, like, charter schools is really working. They might be able to obscure those numbers and say right up front, okay, well, we don't want to bring in any students who are of a certain background. You know, we don't want to bring in any students who have learning disabilities because we don't want to provide those services to them. In the public school system, by law, you have to provide those services to all the students, no matter what. And so, you know, they push out, they don't accept certain students, and then if there are students that are failing, they just push them out of that system. It's an awful system, but it's just another example of how, you know, those services like, you know, healthcare, education, public transportation that I mentioned are being privatized, and there's a profit incentive to that too. I mean, some of these Jeffrey Canada is his name. He's like a guru in the charter school movement. He's a major force that's pushing the privatization of public education, gutting the teachers' unions, screwing over the students, and he and other people like him making a really big profit off of that. But again, you know, going back to, you know, there's always a problem. There's always a solution. And with charter schools, with the plight of adjunct professors in higher ed, that solution is organization. It's forming unions, it's organizing, and it's pushing back.
The fact that there's less and less membership in unions, does that present the problem? In today's society, how do you get somebody to join a union and organize and agitate when the mindset's not there?
Right. That's a very good question. I think, again, this is something we've seen across the board. We've seen union membership dwindle in both the public and private sector in this country with a major onslaught on labor for decades now. I think, you know, and when I think of public school system, you know, this is just generally speaking nationally, not just in New York, but nationally, this is a very well-organized group of workers in terms of unionization. I don't think it's a conspiracy to go out and say that those who have, you know, who have the wealth and power in this country got together and decided what's the next, you know, big group of workers who are unionized and organized that we could go after and just have an all-out war against. That's public school teachers, you know. That being said, yeah, I think a lot of work has to be done in order to build unions and build organization and to push back. And I think part of the blame, you know, is on unions. I think this is, you know, most unions are kind of operating out of this system that is really antiquated, that, you know, the collective bargaining system, which has its roots, you know, in the 1800s, really, but that was set in place by, you know, legally speaking, in the 1930s with the passage during the New Deal of the NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act, also known as the Wagner Act. That's when the National Labor Relations Board and other similar kind of authorities and quasi-legal agencies and departments were set up to kind of facilitate a safer route or a safer form of resistance that was going on in the 1930s. I mean, I'm very critical of the whole kind of collective bargaining system and structure of, and so for folks who don't know, it's building a majority of support for a union in the workplace. It's organizing the workplace and building up for, you know, towards a union election. And then after that, there's a bargaining process where both management and the workers, you know, sit at the table and they bargain for a collective, you know, like a mutually agreed upon union contract. The workers would have to ratify. But that, in a sense, it puts a straitjacket on workers because, generally speaking, in these union contracts, there is a no-strike clause. So workers are put in this straitjacket where, for the life of the contract, they cannot go on strike. They cannot do other, you know, certain forms of collective action. There are management rights clauses for the bosses in these union contracts and, you know, including, like, the right to have, like, sole power and, like, decision-making power over, you know, for example, like, if management wants to shut down a factory or a business or workplace, they have the power to do that in most cases. And workers have no say in that. That right was in part given away completely and legally speaking to bosses and employers, you know, through this whole collective bargaining process. So, and at that time in the 1930s, you know, just, and I think this, you know, it's a bit of the history of the past, but it really, I think, sheds some light on how we got into this mess that we're in now on our end, on like labor's end and our end as workers and unions, and also how to like question that and get out of it. But when the Wagner Act in the 1930s was legislated, 1934, there are four major uprisings of workers in this country. So one, the Toledo Autolite strike, the, you know, Minneapolis Teamster strike. There's a major strike in Appalachia of textile workers from, you know, Georgia all the way up to Pennsylvania, essentially. And there's a West Coast waterfront strike, which shut down, you know, all the ports, you know, longshore workers. These are not just strikes. There are major rebellions that involved millions and millions and millions of workers. The government was terrified, and in response to that, you know, the New Deal was passed to say, okay, you know, you want unions, we're going to give you that right, the government's going to back you up, and the government will act as a neutral, like, arbiter in this process. And that, it just doesn't work. I mean, the government, in my view, is a committee of the rich. And so they will never really fully come down on side of the workers. So the question is now, with the question you asked, how, like, what do we do? There's like less people that are in unions. There's lower union density. I think we need to critically examine the kinds of the forms and organizational forms of resistance in terms of tactics, but also strategy that we as workers are taking, you know, and assess like what is working and what isn't. And quite frankly, I think what does work is that kind of model that is, say, the industrial workers of the world, the IWW, the Wobblies, so, like, organizing all workers as a class into one big union across industries, and, you know, not giving away things like the right to strike, and having those more kind of creative forms of resistance, but disruptive forms of resistance that disrupts and puts a stop to business as usual. And I think the best, one of the best weapons is a strike.
Great. So, you know, in the final analysis, do you think that people will join unions, agitate for change, or will things keep going the way they are right now?
I think that, you know, the silver lining of, and these problems aren't new, but I think the silver lining with a shift in kind of political direction, although I think it's been going on the same path for many decades, but since, like, Trump came to power, yes, there's been a number of things that are deeper, that are worse, that are different. But, you know, this is the end result of decades of, you know, this kind of what I was talking about earlier, the financialization of capital. You know, you chip away at a public safety net, you chip away at public transportation, at healthcare, at public education, at higher education, and all these other things. Factories are closing down, jobs are closing down. You know, more and more people are adjuncts, more and more people are Uber drivers. They don't have anywhere else to look. And that's when you see, you know, people like Trump, you know, ascend and come to power because they spoke to some of that. Of course, you know, it's a false opposition. And, you know, it's also backed by white supremacy and by the very same forces that have been screwing us over for many decades. So I think the silver lining in all of this, of course, is that, at least in my experience as an organizing adjunct faculty, is that you know, more and more adjunct professors are getting fed up, are organizing, are standing up, are fighting back. You know, there's some really exciting moments too. A couple of years ago, the adjunct faculty at Ithaca College were gearing up to go on strike, and they called it off at the last minute because the administration caved at the 11th hour and met pretty much all of their demands. But even just that power or that threat, I should say the threat of a strike does hold power, you know, and it does have a ripple effect. And I've seen it, you know, at the grassroots level. I've seen it in talking to adjunct professors all over the place. So I think more and more people are open to unionization, at least, you know, in my experience from what I've seen, and also especially with the younger generation. I mean, you know, there are younger people in this country for the first time in many, many decades. Socialism, however they define that, or at least the rejection of capitalism, is just something that's more and more popular. It's something that more and more people are open to, especially younger folks. And I think the rebellions in Ferguson and Baltimore with the Black Lives Matter movement, I think, although it's several years ago at this point, Occupy Wall Street, I mean, those were good signs that, you know, there is an awakening from younger people in particular, and, you know, kind of questioning not just specific politicians, but the whole system that we have in place. And there's a more of an openness towards what an alternative might look like. And part of getting to that alternative is joining a union, forming a union, and deeper and further organization.
So, Brendan, let's talk again, you know, at a future date. Let's keep this conversation going. Would you be interested in doing that?
Absolutely.
Great. So you've been listening to Brendan Dunn, and he's with the IWW, and he's been speaking about organizing adjunct professors. So if you like the show, like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, All Exits Closed. Brendan, thank you for taking the time to be on All Exits Closed, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day.
Thank you.